ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
They prayed, they preached, they rebelled. From God Forbid, this is the Religious Rebels podcast. The stories of people who defied empires and sometimes paid with their lives. From Joan of Arc's battlefield visions to Malcolm X's final revelation, we tell the stories of those who defied faith and remade it. Religious Rebels, the original disruptors. Search for God Forbid ABC wherever you get your podcasts or on the ABC Listen app.
Hello again, Robin Williams with The Science Show, in which we ask you to do a little thought experiment. There's no doubt in Australia now that we're keen to sell our special minerals and rare earths to America and others who are keen to get them. We're also talking lots about nuclear submarines, maybe nuclear power, and yes, such medical devices. And we know in mental health care it's often hard to find the therapists we need for young and old. So geologists, nuclear technologists, psychologists, the list goes on. Why, pray, aren't we preparing for the future that's so clear and obvious? Needing young trained scientists and technologists as well as tradespeople from TAFE, some of whom may like to top up sometime with university training. What do you think? First, let's meet Indrani Mukherjee from the University of New South Wales, where she's a senior lecturer in geology. Why are you worried about the ability of Australia to handle all these rare earths that we are being asked for?
Well, it's because I have seen the decline in the popularity of geosciences before my eyes in the last 10 years that I've been in Australia. So the reason I left India to come to Australia was because of its world-class reputation in geology. And right before my eyes, I have seen that go really, really down. Not just that the popularity has declined, alongside that, we have seen geology departments either shrink or being completely wiped out from universities. And the reason I'm worried, and it's an understatement, I'm actually really concerned that governments are signing billion-dollar deals for rare earths, critical elements, in the hope that they're going to find a critical minerals deposit. It doesn't work that way. My concern is, who exactly is going to find these critical minerals?
We don't have enough geophysicists anymore.
Well, geophysicists or geologists, so there's no branch of geoscience that's a critical minerals branch. Lots of different sub-disciplines within the broader field of geoscience will feed into a particular mineral deposit exploration. So geophysics, geochemistry, you need structural geology to understand the overall structure of the area where these mineral deposits are.
By the way, what's your speciality?
I'm a geochemist, so I look at the chemistry of ancient rocks, in particular sediment-hosted mineral deposit. Commodities of interest would be zinc, copper, both of which are strategic metals, and help the minerals industry to better explore by devising mineralization vectors from the data that we collect.
And what's this rock you've brought with you? It's quite large. It's red.
I'm so glad you brought this up, because geologists are so worried about losing out that we always talk about critical elements. There is more to geology than just critical elements. I'm holding in front of you 3.5 billion-year-old stromatolite. This is the most conclusive evidence of the origins of life on our planet. Our planet, we've got 4.56 billion years history. By the way, that understanding, that same history is going to help us explore for critical elements that politicians and everyone else just uses those words, including the media. It's everywhere in the news.
Let me hold it. I've never held anything. 3.5 billion.
This is from our own backyard in Western Australia.
Oh, gosh. Because there are some elements there that are even older. You can still find them, can't you?
Absolutely. And we were just talking about with the students that this is what will enable us to understand how microbial life in particular, because ancient Earth had... I know everyone's so fascinated with dinosaurs and everything big, but really life back then was very microscopic, and it's very hard for them to be preserved in the rock record like macroscopic fossils. But they do leave behind these beautiful layered structures. So that's what you can see here. This is like a time capsule. You can go back and understand how life originated, how it thrived. Also, these microbial populations, they're dead now, but this is what they've left behind. These were responsible for the oxygen in the atmosphere that you and I take granted for today. But back then, there was very little oxygen. And so over time, it was the prevalence of these microbial populations that enabled the oxygen concentrations to grow into appreciable amounts.
Yes. Now, what's putting off the young people from choosing geology? Is it because they associate it with only mining? Or, you know, because what you just told me is really so exciting. And we've said before on The Science Show, if you're interested in geology, you can be concerned about the coastline. Wonderful and absolutely vital. You can do what David Flannery does at QUT, which is run the Mars Explorer and tell NASA where to go next with the little machine. I mean, it's so exciting. Why aren't they?
Well, so it's not like geology had thousands of people and students flocking back in the days. You've got to be on the spectrum somewhere in the geology spectrum to want to learn more. I hated geology in my first year, hated it with passion. There were too many terms that you're not introduced in high school, so it's a lot of information overload. It's an acquired taste. And so we've always had a small pool of students that develop that interest over time. It is fascinating. So, you know, I'm a converted, so there are lots of people who look at rocks right when they were like 2 years old or something. I don't have a story like that, and a lot of people don't. But then there are students who are really lured into the subject once they start to understand and able to visualize the geology and the concept of time scale, etc. There is, in the East Coast in particular, there is a negative connotation with mining because they read in the newspaper, and sure, all the bad stories should be out there. Good stories aren't out there as much. So I tried really hard in my first year to help them kind of balance it out. So we've had a small pool of people always interested in this field. We want that because they are the ones who are passionate about the field of geosciences. They're going to want to do great things when they've got the necessary training. What's happened now, because geoscience departments are shrinking, we are diluting the level and the content a bit.
May I ask you what you thought of Professor Chinnapati Jagadish talking in Canberra the other day?
Yeah, I was very pleased to have been there at the Shine Dome, but also it was very concerning to all the things he had to say. And I was very nice to see the top body in Australia acknowledge the skills gap in our geoscience capabilities. He specifically mentions, when the report was officially released, that there is a serious gap in our geoscience capability. But, you know, a lot of people have told me, you can't just whinge, you've got to come up with a solution. Well, here's the solution. He's given us the warning at the Australian Academy of Science event. In the next 10 years, things will go really haywire if we don't do something now. Well, let's do something now. We still have time. In the next 10 years, let's rejuvenate the geoscience departments in this country. We can do it. We already have them. And let's train the next generation of geoscientists. We have a fair number of students, Robin, but we have very, as he pointed out, Professor Jagadish, we need domestic students. So we want homegrown talent that we train to be able to cater to the needs of the future of this country. Right now, we have a student body, but a lot of them take the training and they will go back to their countries. We need the skills to remain in this country. And for that, domestic students is our best option. Domestic students, he clearly pointed out, not just in geoscience, but science in general, there's a huge decline.
May I just whinge to you about one of the things that gives me the abdabs every time I go out? If it's a short walk, I will find 10 cans, aluminium cans, lying there chucked away. If it's a long walk, there could be a sack full. And as Veena Sarajwala from your own university, yes, a genius, understands, told me last night actually, because it's 5% of the energy to turn those cans back into the aluminium you can use. 5% of the energy that you would otherwise use for the alumina, you know, getting it from the ore. Why aren't people more aware of this?
Yeah, and the same thing with zinc. I look at sediment-hosted zinc deposits. Zinc is 100% recyclable. We're only recycling 30%. go figure. So that's another thing that we could be doing is maybe not need so much. You know, we keep saying, oh, critical elements and this and that. Well, maybe our demand should go down a bit and maybe we could recycle. Yeah, that's exactly right. You can do it. Each one of us can do little things that can make a difference.
So, to the young people, study geology.
Oh, my gosh, please, just do it. But, you know, we need to have the right environment for them to study as well. In the next 10 years, young students these days press for cash, whatever, they'll want to have a job at the end of their degree. This is a workforce, critical minerals workforce. There will be a huge demand. So if we can prepare them for that workforce, then they will enroll. But the problem is, Robin, we don't have a very good facility in place because we've shrunk over the years. And so the content is quite diluted. So if we can create the good, necessary environment for these students to take geoscience and then do something with it in 10 years' time. Because I can tell you one thing, that Donald Trump is not going to come and find the critical elements that he so confidently said that we'll have so much of it that we won't know what to do with it. I'd be very surprised to see what his plan is.
Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you so much, Robin. Appreciate your time.
Dr. Indrani Mukherjee, Senior Lecturer at the University of New South Wales, and I shall talk to the President of the Australian Academy of Science about that on The Science Show next week. By the way, you may recall the campaign we saw run from the Australian Museum and to Macquarie University about 3 years ago on this very topic, and it was in The Science Show as well. Geologist for Australia. So, mentioned just now, someone who's famous here and globally for her work recycling minerals. Millions of waste tyres to make green steel. Microfactories in every council wanting them to recycle e-waste. Professor Veena Sahajwala, who launched the book Best Australian Science Writing on the importance of storytelling to excite young minds. Veena.
It's exactly the kind of story that reminds me why I believe that storytelling is the kind of bridge that we need between research and understanding. These stories show that science isn't just about data. It's about people, it's about communities and the connections that we make through inquiry and curiosity. They remind us that the greatest discoveries, whether it's finding solutions to ghost nets, understanding ancient ecosystems, or indeed tracing the ripple effects of air conditioning on our planet, they happen when diverse minds come together and are willing to listen, to learn and to act. In a world where, of course, we've got so much information, good science writing cuts through that noise. It builds trust, it provides context, and it shows why the work matters. It reminds us that innovation doesn't just stop in our lab. It thrives when people can imagine, can understand, and participate in solutions. In our work at the Smart Center at UNSW, that's exactly the kind of work we want to do, where it's not just about saying we're all about understanding the complexities of waste. We're about saying, how do we actually address the challenges? And are those challenges offering us new opportunities? So the fact that we can look at e-waste, batteries, and a whole range of complex plastics and glass, and take that into remanufacturing, but to do that in a way where local communities could benefit, is something that our students, our staff, get the thrills out of. They love the fact that we could be working in partnership with Liverpool City Council, setting up our microfactories there, and the joy of watching waste mattresses, yes, waste mattresses, that of course would have ended up in landfill, to take all that fabric waste and convert that into hard green ceramic tiles. Yes, who would have thought? Soft fabric into hard green ceramic tiles. And we want to, of course, show that Australia is the forefront of discovery, is at the forefront of translation, and also is at the forefront of creating impact in our communities. This is what we love doing at UNSW. And this is why, of course, the future generations will look upon the work and the scientific discoveries that we're all making today and imagining what that future could look like. So, of course, to address some of these challenges, we want to make sure that it's not just about how we engage with corporates that might have the funds to be able to deploy these solutions. We also want to work with communities where we can show that scalability done right at the right level can deliver on that impact at all scales. And this is why, of course, for us at the Smart Center, we know it is important to be able to work with industry, with communities, and to be able to then collectively tackle these challenges that societies face. Who would have thought that our partners in a local government like that of Liverpool City Council would get so excited about the fact that all of that fabulous waste is now becoming part of world-leading technological advances that are being deployed in the form of these microfactories. But of course, what this also has been born out of is the fact that great science writing and communication is about inspiring people into action. It's about transforming that data and that knowledge into empathy. And that is why, of course, scientists themselves have to play a very important role. So when we, of course, talk about our science in a way that is accessible, what we are doing is we're extending the reach of our work and we are demonstrating how we can deliver on impact. When scientists communicate, they build trust. They, of course, show that they are ready to engage and deliver on impact. They remind the public that, of course, science is not just something that is done once and left, but it's a process that evolves, that corrects itself, that goes back to seek the truth. And of course, even when the answers are uncomfortable, we're ready to engage and talk about it. And for, of course, professional science writers and journalists and editors and communicators, the challenge is both creative as well as ethical. It's ultimately about making that complexity engaging, but never trivial. Done well, science writing invites people not just to consume knowledge, but to think scientifically, to question, to test, and to wonder. And that's exactly what we do here at UNSW. We create real-world impact through science and research, and in collaboration with industry and communities, we actually co-develop and co-implement these ideas and pilot and test them in the real-world situation. So whether you're a researcher, a student, a journalist, or simply a curious reader, remember, of course, that every time you communicate science clearly, you expand its reach. And ultimately, the stories that we are about to experience in this beautiful piece of work today is about ultimately to make the complex relatable. That's really what we're all about. And we want to, of course, look forward to the future. And we want to be able to see the challenges. We know that the world doesn't only need brilliant scientists and science, it also needs brilliant communicators of science, people who can translate that complexity into clarity. And of course, it's when that science is translated, it not only informs, it empowers. Thank you very much for having me here.
Thank you. Thank you, Veena, for that beautiful launch of another edition of the Best Australian Science Writing.
Cathy Bale of New South Wales Press thanking Professor Veena Sahajwala, former Australian of the Year in New South Wales, and role model for how to bring top tech to your local community. E-waste, polystyrene, old mattresses to building tiles, the lot. So there's plenty to get on with now. So let's next ask the new president of Science and Technology Australia, Jazz Chambers, normally working with the oceans, on her fresh role.
Congratulations. And when do you actually become the president?
On the 13th of November, and I'm counting down and grabbing a coffee with the current president to basically ingest his brains.
And this is a body that includes most of the societies of different professions in science altogether.
Correct, that's right. Science and Technology Australia is the peak body for science and technology, and we represent about 140 organisations, and within that membership about 235,000 scientists and technologists across Australia.
Just to give a good hoy to the tradition, Emma Johnston, now the Vice-Chancellor of the University of Melbourne, yes, was on there as well.
That's right. I joined the board actually when she was president, and amazing leadership.
You've got a challenge to follow up, haven't you?
Oh, absolutely. I think all the presidents, I've had four presidents in front of me, and they've all brought exceptional leadership to the role, all very different. But yeah, I'm looking forward to the challenge.
So a professional body, how do you manage to deal with the ministers? Because I think it was the chief scientist, Alan Finkel, when he was there before Kathy Foley, he said, what you need not to do is walk into the minister's office and immediately ask for more money, because everyone does that. And she's probably heard that 20 times today.
I completely agree with that. I think coalescing what the ask is incredibly important for the science community. I myself have sat on many a budget review team over the years. And if the community has not had that conversation about what they're clear priorities are, then an ask from all different sections can be tiring to receive. So I think it is important for us to be really clear about what it is that we care about collectively.
As I read the newspapers, and I still do that sort of thing, newspapers are quite interesting, except week after week you get bad news stories regarding certain parts of the scientific enterprise. ANSTO, et cetera, was the last one a few days ago. Why is there this continuing bad news?
There's good news too. I think that all of that needs to be taken into the context of where is Australia putting its investment and its time? What's the Australian strategy? And I guess where do the powers that be and those that who are designing this strategy see science and technology? And I think that's the question that we need to be asking. Where's our voice in those rooms? And if we're not in those rooms right now, why is that the case? When there's plenty of evidence in terms of the policy settings and stated desires from government that we're looking for solutions to some of the big problems.
One of the problems with scientists is it takes a little while to train them and get them to qualify. And when they get to about early 20s, mid-20s, when you got your PhD, you've been studying and studying and studying for all this time. And then you look around for jobs. And we see that some people in the science, for instance, of geology, saying you're talking about rare earths and these minerals, but you don't have the geologists actually to advise and be in the field to make it happen. The same sort of thing goes with AUKUS and our nuclear subs, let alone the idea that we might go in for nuclear energy, who knows. But AD and various other people who've been heads of this outfit will tell you, you're not training the people who can actually make it happen should you decide that way. What's going on?
I think you're picking up on an area of deep interest and passion for me, which is around the training of scientists. So I worked in higher education for 20 years. And I think that one thing that we do in science, and when you train people as undergraduates, their timetables are full to the brim. Unlike many other types of degrees, a minimum timetable would be 18 hours up to anywhere up to into the 30 hours a week of heavy scientific content. And you've got to add into that people in the laboratory, people in the field or at the blackboard. So the actual program and the way that we train people is heavy going. There's also then not a lot of space in the curriculum for other interest areas. And I think this is one of the things that we've noticed at Science and Technology Australia is the ability for our scientific community to connect in their 20s and 30s, as you've suggested, to business and to an understanding of governance and the economy and finance and how those things work. So there's something to me around the training and then the ability for people in the STEM sector to actually have an entree into how their work is going to matter, that's heavy scientific technical aspects of what they do, how that's going to matter to the economy and actually be able to communicate that well. Because clearly our extraordinary training of people is part of this, but I think that's also to the relevance around recruiting people into science, showing them the path that is going, yes, you're going to do science, you're going to become expert at this area, and you're going to contribute to society and the economy in this way. And I think that we've got a bit of work to do around that.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's not a narrow path, because I'm thinking about geology again. I know people who study geology and they end up being in charge of looking after the coastline.
Yeah.
Or one of them, called David Flannery at QUT, is actually looking at images from Mars, from the Explorer, and telling NASA where it should go beyond that next boulder.
Yeah.
It can take you almost anywhere. And similarly, engineering,
absolutely,
getting the young people to sign up to science and not be put off by the old-fashioned label.
I think you're exactly right. It's not narrow, but do we tell and explain the story of where you could go? And it isn't until, in my experience, people have developed some leadership capability and have demonstrated that, that they start being given opportunities. And that's generally happening in their 30s and 40s. And that's when they start seeking out, okay, I think I need extra skills here. I don't know how to read a balance sheet. I don't know how to talk to bankers and finance people. We could actually be providing some of that experience earlier in people's careers, people management and so forth. And also then when you are recruiting students into science, explaining those pathways better. And that's where I think that we've got a bit of work to do there.
Finally and briefly, are you going to keep in touch with Oceans?
Absolutely. I don't give up my day job on Ocean. I am very much of the view that Australia needs to get its governance right around Ocean. We have a space agency in Australia, which I think is terrific, but we don't have an ocean agency. And I think that that's pretty strange. So I'll be working on that as well.
Thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Jazz Chambers, who graduated in both psychology and marine science, and has held a clutch of top positions over the years, and who became president of Science and Technology Australia just days ago. The Science Show on Radio National, and next, how geology and maths can save lives in Iceland. Well, wouldn't you want to save lives in Iceland? H squared would. That's Herbert Huppert, Fellow of King's College Cambridge for 50 years. But he's from Bondi in Sydney. He does the maths of busy liquids, and lava can be very busy and dangerous, running in a hot red tide from a volcano towards you in lots of places. So you need to know lots of possibilities to save lives.
It's a great problem. Particularly, I've become involved with lava flows in Iceland. They don't kill many people in comparison to volcanoes, who can kill up to a million, but they cause enormous damage to buildings. And the Mount St. Helens eruption in 1980 cost $1 billion in the damage it did to buildings. So I thought it would be worthwhile having a meeting discussing lava, how to defend against them and what you might do. And I'd worked a little bit on that beforehand, so I thought it would be nice to have a group of international people get together for a week and talk about the problems and how to resolve them.
And of course, lava comes from volcanoes as well, but is it being emitted from regular holes in the ground rather than in an explosive way, but in a flowing, continual way?
No, it doesn't really come from holes in the ground. It always comes from volcanoes, because it's the molten rock that is kept beneath the surface, and then pressure increases and sends the magma as it is within the Earth, out onto the surface of the Earth when it becomes lava. It's a little bit like a fetus comes out and is a child. So that's why they have the different names. And lava can do lots of damage, and so we wanted to see how to avert that.
When it is a flow like that, is it indefinite? Does it keep going for a long, long, long time?
In geology, a million years is a relatively short time. It doesn't go that long. It solidifies. The question is, how quickly will it solidify and where will it go as it's flowing before it solidifies? Will it go over new topography and cause difficulties in areas that it hasn't caused before? Or will it stop and freeze? And they're the sort of questions we looked at and tried to understand.
And what's the situation? Describe it in Iceland.
There've been really a great problem, quite a few volcanic eruptions and lava flows which have inundated some of their towns, but they have a very good group of people who are trying their best to make the problem as small as possible, and in particular building barriers that stop or slow down the lava flow or divert the lava flow. In recent eruption, they built barriers within a few days. I was amazed at how quickly, because they were all prepared, they managed to build barriers that stopped the flow.
What are the barriers made of?
Well, that's interesting. In Iceland, quite a few of the barriers were just made of large piles of little pieces of rock that they had ready, and they in particular protected a very important communication system without which Iceland might have ended up unknown to the rest of the world.
So this meeting was held. What was the result?
The result was, first of all, not only did we have quite a few lectures, two a day, we also had group meetings, five different groups who talked about different aspects of looking at lava flows and deciding how they might be defended against. And then I have decided that a very important journal that, in fact, mainly edited my wonderful engineer in Melbourne, is going to have a special issue where every paper in that journal is going to report on aspects of lava flows that are needed.
Apart from Iceland, which is a fascinating country but fairly small, where else is this a problem?
Oh, this is a problem in Hawaii, and anywhere that there is a volcano, there'll be a problem associated with it. So it's in the west coast of the United States, in Japan, and a number of places.
So the Ring of Fire, in other words.
Yeah, correct.
And so people have been looking, in the first instance, at the explosion of the volcano and then not sufficiently the end result, which lasts a long time.
Well, the point is that a lot of people, like me, have looked at theoretical questions and can say quite well what will happen if lava that comes out has a definite temperature and viscosity and how it might flow over a smooth surface. That's the simplest mathematical problem. I have done some work looking at lava flows in Iceland over topographic surfaces, and we got really quite good results between our theoretical calculations and what actually happened, and that's important.
So you can tell people how long to pay attention carefully.
Yeah, how long it might take. I mean, we have a first state response, but there's much more that needs to be known. We, or I at least, have always modelled rather simply lava flows as a viscous fluid, but I haven't taken into account that there's a crystal content. I and others haven't taken into account that the topography isn't flat. That's the easiest thing to do, and here in Cambridge, everything is flat.
Now, let me ask you about these gardens. What are they, the gardens you were telling me about before?
Oh, chemical gardens is something totally different. Glauber, a fascinating scientist some 30 years before Newton, invented chemical gardens where you put a very compressed cobalt chloride, for example, into an aqueous solution of sodium sulfate, but there are lots of different things, and gradually sodium sulfate flows into the cobalt chloride, expands it a little bit, and then depending upon concentrations, it'll suddenly explode and rise with a coloured crystal content that looks exactly like flowers and plants, and so that's how they got the name of chemical gardens. They were made even more famous in that in 1977, Alvin, the submersible that is owned by the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute, went down and discovered the first deep sea smokers, basically underwater volcanoes at something like 1.5 kilometres. And there were lots of these chemical gardens around. And the thing that's fascinating about that is there's no free oxygen, there's no sunshine there. So how did these chemical gardens get to be? And some people have seriously argued that this must be the origin of life. And roughly half the people who are knowledgeable about this area think that this is true and this is how we all originated.
How deep does Alvin go? Because it's quite a long way, isn't it?
It sure is. And the fascinating thing about Alvin, it's a very small submersible with a captain and two scientists. And I once asked one of the scientists, what happens if you have a need for something else? And he said, bad luck. You must do it before you get into it. And that having been said, I've met and talked with three scientists, each of whom told me they were on the first voyage that discovered chemical gardens. And I stupidly didn't realise that when the third one said to me that he had been on the voyage, I should have said to him, and who was your companion? And then I would have been able to determine which of the three was lying to me and showing off.
Would you ever dare go down in Alvin? I wouldn't.
Oh, no, I would love to go down in Alvin. And there's never been any problem and more risky to drive a car, especially from Sydney to Melbourne. And Alvin has never had a problem at all. Just like Qantas, the Australian airline, has never, ever been responsible for a death.
Such a range of adventures you can enjoy as a graduate in geology. Saving lives, deep sea diving, visiting volcanoes in Hawaii, add maths, and you'll keep Qantas flying, perhaps. Herbert Huppert has done the lot. Okay, we've added maths to those rocks in geology. Now let's add computers. So dependent on maths, all those noughts and ones, all those algorithms. Here's someone who studies how you and I can interact with the tech, how it works well and not so well. Howie Zhu studies us accordingly.
How much do you think about how technology influences you? Do you think about how you find information? When you have a question, do you look towards something like Google for the answer? How do you interpret the information that Google gives you? Do you weigh it up against what you think? Or do you look at other websites and try to find a sort of amalgamation of opinions? These were a lot of the questions people were asking when the internet first began and when people started using Google search. The same questions can be asked now with AI arising. Ultimately, how will people use AI? How would you find answers from it? How much do you trust what AI is telling you? I'm Howie Zhu. I'm a lecturer of interaction design at the University of Sydney. I am a researcher in a field we call human-computer interaction. At its core, human-computer interaction is the science of how people use technology. We like to observe the ways people use technology and then use that as evidence to inform us on how we make technology. The study of human-computer interaction comes from the sentiment that technology moves fast. And the reality is the way people use technology is constantly changing. In a matter of 20 years, we've used smartphones, we've had laptops. These are all technologies that suddenly popped up and we've started using it more and more regularly. And we also find topics come up like social media ban, online privacy, and AI for education. So ultimately, we often have this question of how do we get enough evidence to understand these hot topics that's coming up? And how do we inform policy on this topic? As scientists, we want to look at how to be more agile. We want to look at how we could study the way people use technology to inform these policies. So what this could look like is, for example, with the social media ban. Could we look at the way people are using social media to then start to form this evidence on understanding human behavior with social media? This way we can actually assess the impacts of it. Using social media, we could look at patterns of sleep. We could understand when people are more active on social media. And from that activity, you can find out when a person's likely to be doom scrolling, when a person's likely to be waking up in the middle of the night and looking for some information nuggets, or when a person wakes up and gets their morning coffee and starts to read the news. These kind of behaviors all help us understand how humans behave, but then also tell us how people are using these technologies. So at its core, human-computer interaction is made up of three things: the human, the computer, and the exploration of how these two interact. So for the human component, we look at you. We consider the human the user. We want to look at how people use technology. Everyone uses technology in unique ways. We form our own personal habits when we use technologies. We look at how people form their unique habits. These habits often form into larger patterns and trends. So by studying people's habits, we can understand how people will use technologies, but also how technology affects us as people. The computer bit is actually a bit of an old-fashioned word in my space. When we think of computers, we often think of sort of the 70s and 90s attitude, where a computer was just a computer on a desk where you can use during your job. Nowadays, the word computer encompasses all technology. We often think of a computer not as just a desktop computer, but also your laptop, also your phone, also your watch. Everything nowadays has technology that has a computer chip in it. So nowadays, with all this technology around us, we really need to start to think about how these technologies are listening and responding to us. We're not just directly interacting with these technologies, but these technologies are also measuring our heart rate. They're measuring how we sleep. They're measuring how we move, how many steps we take. And we often like to utilize these things to actually understand how we behave. But we also want to start to think about how does technology use that and how does that actually understand us as people better, or how do we understand ourselves more? So with technology appearing more and more in our everyday life, now's the time to really study this interaction between how people use technology. With these new hot topics, we want to now pay attention to how we use and how we live and work with these technologies. How do we use this to connect with others? Social media is a new thing that's come up that people have actually now become so connected with each other, where we can actually look at so many more different behaviors of how people talk, how people work, and how people really see each other online. In my research, I tend to look at the imperfect situations. I look at situations when you may be stressed, when you may be tired. Do you think about when you're stressed, how do you change your behavior when you're on social media? Do you use social media to vent your stresses? Or when you're tired, do you find yourself wanting to just turn off your phone and not use it at all? My work looks at these situations. How could we build technologies to not just cater for a particular situation, but also cater to all facets of your life? Because ultimately, it comes both ways, where a technology's context does matter, but the technology also sticks around with you throughout all different contexts. The reality is, it could be thinking about AI. Do you use AI to just study, or are you going to use AI to ask questions about life? Are you going to ask AI for a cooking recipe? Or could you be asking AI for medical advice or emotional support? These are very complex topics. And by studying how we behave in these imperfect situations, we can actually shape AI to be more responsible, but also be more adaptive to what's going on in your life, to understand your situation and provide hopefully ethical advice on how this could be used for you. What should we be thinking about right now? I don't want to prescribe too much on how you should necessarily behave. I think there's a natural aspect of how you use technology. but start to pay attention to how you use tech in your life. A lot of these policies around you are shaped actually by how you use this tech. If you want to think about social media as a parent or as an educator or even as a child, the ban is going to come into place. But what you want to look at is then how would this shift the way we use technology? Will we move towards things like gaming more? Or will we move to sports more? There's a lot of these changes that will happen. And actually, these changes will be informed by how you, as a human or as a user, use the technology in your life. People will be observing it and then making decisions. So now is really the time to be more observant on how you use tech and think about how you want to shape the policies around technology.
Howie Zhu, one of this year's ABC Top 5 scientists from the University of Sydney. Yes, top. As you know, this is an elitist program. Recently, we've had Nobel Prize winners, the Prime Minister, the President of the Royal Society of London, so it's entirely appropriate that we finish today with the top quark. James Joyce was not thinking of frontier physics, as he wrote Finnegan's Wake, but a Nobel laureate read that strange book and knew immediately that quark it had to be. So in the interest of recruiting the next generation of physicists in Australia and celebrating the 100th anniversary of quantum, here's Jay Howarth from Scotland.
I'm celebrating myself by trying to use this century-old theory, which has been wildly successful and is now finally, after a century, having real-world applications. I'm trying to apply these techniques to new areas where they haven't been used before. And for me, that's high-energy hadron colliders.
High-energy hadron? Do you mean the hadron collider they have now is not high energy?
No, I do mean the hadron collider we have now. So I work on the Large Hadron Collider on the ATLAS experiment at CERN.
You go to Switzerland?
Yes, not so much since COVID, but we try and get out there at least once every 2 months or so. My students are out there permanently.
While I'm being supercilious, is it true that they have a mouse cage there, which are in fact the mice used on computers with those strings attached?
Yes. CERN is an unusual place. I think people expect it to be this beautiful utopia of science. And honestly, it looks like a 1960s Soviet era kind of town. In almost every corridor, though, there are these giant bins full of expired computing equipment, not just mice, but old computers, old floppy disks, old bits of machinery, and they're everywhere. I don't know where it comes from or how they get refilled constantly, but there's a huge amount of tech going back to the 80s and 70s just lying around in bins in the corridors.
Why don't they recycle it?
I think a lot of it is supposed to be recycled. I just don't know where it keeps coming from. It must be stored in cupboards and some people periodically empty them. But
okay, your work. You're in the High Energy Hadron Collider. What's the first experiment that you do and what are you looking for?
So I look at something called spin correlation. So I work on the top quark. This is the heaviest particle that exists in nature. It doesn't exist naturally anymore. We have to produce it at these machines. But it's a really useful thing for playing around with quantum concepts because we can accurately measure its spin. And when we produce them in pairs, we can compare the spin of one to another and learn all kinds of interesting information from this.
Is this where entanglement comes on? Because if there are a pair of them, they'll spin in the same direction even if you separate them.
Yes, that's a really interesting thing about top quarks. When you make them in pairs, sometimes they're entangled and sometimes they're not. So this actually allows us to play a lot of games by trying to select the ones that are entangled and compare them to the ones that aren't, and from this, understand the effects that quantum mechanics can actually have on fundamental particles.
By the way, how do you know the top quark used to be out there in the wild?
We can't go back in time and check what the Big Bang looked like. It would be very nice if we could. We can only produce it in environments which have extremely high energy. You need a lot of energy to create a top quark. They have a single top quark has the mass of nearly the mass of a gold nucleus, which I can tell you is very, very heavy as far as these things go. So the last time that sort of energy existed in the universe was just a few milliseconds after the Big Bang.
And when you've produced what you want, how long does it last itself? Nanoseconds?
Much shorter than that. It has a lifetime of 10 to the minus 25 seconds, so that's 0.25 zeros. It's one of the shortest lived particles that exists. In fact, that's one of the most unique properties about it. One of the reasons that we can test it so well is actually because it decays before it has time to interact with anything else.
So your joy is short-lived.
It's very short-lived, but that makes it very special. That's why I'm particularly fond of it.
And you've got a recording that means something to other scientists when you show them.
Yes, we actually have a plethora of top quarks at the LHC now. It used to be they were quite difficult to produce and we only had a few thousand. Now we have millions and millions of these stored on tape that we can use to perform all kinds of different experiments.
Such as?
Well, spin correlation and quantum information is one of the things I do, but these are also a really good place to look for the production of new particles because they're so heavy. If there's some even heavier particle out there, it's likely the top quark would be the first thing they decay to. So we can use top quarks to search for even heavier new particles.
As you're in Scotland, isn't that where the Higgs lives?
That's where Peter Higgs studied and worked, yes. We have a fond...
While he was alive?
While he was alive, yes. I was not going to go that macabre with it. But yes, there's a huge history of particle physics research. And of course, Peter Higgs, who along with some collaborators, Engelbert and Broke, theorized the Higgs boson as a mechanism for giving fundamental particles their mass.
That's what I meant. The mass comes from there, the heaviness thereof. Although it's better to say mass, isn't it, rather than heaviness?
Yeah, I mean, with these kind of things, you're talking about mathematical concepts, so always the language is failing a little bit here. But mass is fine, yeah. It's the amount of mass the fundamental particles have. You can call them heavy. The top quark is heavy, we say that all the time.
When you've got the theory worked out, the top quark's there as faint memories, but recorded. The significance, what do you do next?
The thing you want to do with top quarks, and another reason they're very nice, is they have a very clear signature of how they decay. And the ones we like tend to be the ones that decay to what's called a B quark and a W boson, which is another kind of heavy particle. And then, most importantly, that W boson can decay to a charged lepton. And particle physicists love charged leptons. This is what an electron is, for example, or muons that you might have heard of in cosmic rays and things like this. We love those kind of particles because they're very stable and they produce really obvious signals in your experimental apparatus. So we can measure them very accurately and use it to infer things about the parent top quark that they came from.
And all of this is confirming the standard model of physics, and it's making you reassured that you've got the ideas right.
It's confirming it to a frustrating degree. I think a lot of us would be much happier if the standard model were less successful than it is, because although it is a really successful and very nice model, we don't believe it's the fundamental one that governs the entire universe. There are things that it can't explain, but it's been so good at explaining everything we see up until now. It's not reassuring as much as it is a bit frustrating. We'd all really like to find something that it doesn't agree with.
Okay, well, congratulations. I can see how you're celebrating the 100th anniversary of quantum. But we've mentioned a couple of names, Higgs and a couple of ones before that. But what about James Clerk Maxwell? What are you doing with his celebration?
A few years, I think it's 2029, but I'd have to double check. But we are having the anniversary of the birth of James Clerk Maxwell, really famous and important scientist, physicist who worked on electromagnetism. And there will be all kinds of events celebrating his achievements, both scientific and cultural, around the UK and particularly in Scotland.
Uh-huh. And you're preparing for that now?
We're planning for it to be a big thing, so it takes quite a few years to prepare in advance. These big events don't just happen on a whim. So yes, it's something we're preparing quite far in advance.
A final question, just in case people think I've left it out. Does your work in any way have anything to do with quantum computers?
Peripherally, yes. So the really nice thing about quantum 100 years later is that it's having practical applications now. But we still don't understand quantum mechanics perfectly. And if we're going to transition to an economy and a technology base that widely uses quantum information, we better understand it as well as we can and test it under every condition we can possibly test it against. So that's one of the reasons it's nice to try it, look at it at the Hadron Collider, because we can test it under really, really extreme conditions. We're not going to have PCs and mobile phones with quantum chips in sticking in the Hadron Collider, obviously, but it can help elucidate bits of the theory that might not be quite complete.
So you do your experiment in the gigantic international confines of CERN and the Hadron Collider. Your quest for the top quark is successful and it exists there for you for less than a nanosecond, much less. And then you relish the recorded memory. Oh, the joys of the nuclear zoo. Jay Howarth is a senior lecturer at the University of Glasgow celebrating 100 years of quantum. And that's The Science Show. Don't forget, we do need more geologists and psychologists and nuclear physicists, but not all combined in one degree. Production by David Fisher. I'm Robin Williams, and this is CPE Bach.